I still remember the first time I went on a roller coaster. I was in the fifth grade, and my school was taking a class excursion to Carowinds. I was pretty sure this was going to be the best day of my life. However, as soon as we pulled into the parking lot of this amusement park, my amusement changed into panic. Because when I saw how tall these rides were and how fast they were moving, I decided right then and there, before I ever walked through the turnstile to get into the park, that my feet were not going to be leaving the ground that day. I convinced myself from the bus in the parking lot that people were dying here every day, and the media simply wasn't doing its job to report it. Well, that all quickly changed, and before I knew it, I found myself in line for Thunder Road. I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but there were many factors that led me to find myself in line. Back then, in those days, the line for Thunder Road was a very long line. I'm sure at least it felt like I was in that line for an hour or more, waiting to go on this roller coaster. And the closer I got to the front of the line, the more the panic and the nausea in my heart was starting to build. I looked behind me and realized there's this whole mass of people who have filled in the cattle stalls behind me, and I can't easily get out. At the same time, I'm not just trapped by these hordes of people. I'm trapped by peer pressure of my friends. I'm trapped by the unstated assumption that all cool kids go on roller coasters and like it. So I really felt stuck. Well, then finally it gets to be my turn where I have to step into the next car. And I literally thought for a moment, I don't need to step into the roller coaster. I could step through the roller coaster and run to the exit and not stop running until I got to the bus. But I didn't. I sat down and I fastened my seatbelt. And then I felt really sick when this ride operator came by and lowered the lap belt on me. And I tugged at it and realized I'm beyond the point of no return. I'm going to go on this ride whether I want to go on this ride. And I don't want to go on this ride. But I'm stuck and I have to go. I share this experience because I think this is how a lot of people that I talk to on almost a daily basis as a pastor, as a counselor, this is how you feel spiritually. You feel like certain things have happened in your life that almost like forces beyond your control have pushed you into a situation that now you're trapped. You're stuck where you are, whether it's with a trial in your life, a testing, an adversity, or maybe even a temptation. Very often I get this kind of feedback that here we are minding our own business, hearts as good as gold, and just bam, out of nowhere, we get innocently sucked into temptations that are just beyond our ability to endure. And people tell me all the time in counseling, you don't understand, I had no choice but to sin. I got sucked along, and once I got to a certain point, there was no way back out. There was no way to save face. There was no way to escape. And I just wonder, as we start this message this morning from 1 Corinthians 10, do you ever feel that way? Do you ever feel like a temptation is so persistent, it just won't go away, or it's so powerful, the forces are beyond your personal control, that you feel like there's nothing I can do to resist this temptation? I have to sin here. Do you ever feel so deeply discouraged in your heart because you feel like I have tried and tried and tried to beat this one sin that keeps coming back over and over and over again, and I'm depressed about it. I'm discouraged. I wish I could say that I had what it took to resist it, to endure it, to run from it, but I never feel like I'm going to be able to find within myself the strength to defeat this temptation. Or changing the illustration a little bit, what about a trial? It's not an enticement for you to sin, but it's just an adversity, a test in your life. And again, this morning, you're at the point of feeling so deeply discouraged because you feel like with this unemployment, with this health, with this relationship, with this whatever it is, finances, I'm beyond the end of my rope. I do not have the strength to hold on one more day. At least that's how it feels. And no matter how hard I try to hang on, I feel like I'm always losing my grip. I feel like this test always has the upper hand in my life, and I'm always going to be discouraged. Well, whatever you feel right now this morning about temptations and trials and adversity in your life, we've come to a very practical verse this morning, 1 Corinthians 10:13. And Paul writes to the church in Corinth, "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but will with the temptation also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it." And then verse 14 adds, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." As I started mapping out this, really just one verse this morning, mainly, I thought, you know, this is going to be one of the simplest messages I've ever taught. This one verse, there's 3 points here that are really simple. Paul basically just says, if you want to endure temptation, if you want to successfully face adversity in your life with victory spiritually, here's 3 things you need to do. Number one, stop making excuses. How do you feel when someone catches you doing something wrong, saying something wrong, and points it out to you? When I look at my own heart, I realize our own initial gut reaction so often is just to be defensive. It is to launch into this denial mode. And all the time I hear, "I didn't do that. I didn't say that. That's not what I meant." Things like that. And then if nobody's buying our outright denial, we change tactics a little bit and we start incorporating some excuse making, some blame shifting, some things like that. And I often feel like a lot of my time spent in counseling is just unraveling this whole web of excuses and rationalizations and blame shifting just to get someone to say, "Okay, you know what? I was wrong." Because that's a starting point for going anywhere and any kind of life change. But do you ever find yourself saying things like this to someone, or maybe even just in your own head? "You don't understand." Or, "I had no choice but to do this or to say this. I was stuck. God gave me this desire. I couldn't help myself." Or very often I just hear, "Yeah, I sinned, but it's not that big a deal." You know, I think excuses really kind of boil down to 3 different things I hear over and over and over again. Number one, people say, "My situation is so unique. Nobody can relate to me. Nobody understands the forces and the dynamics that I faced in this specific instance. And you can't tell me that you relate to me or that anybody else here relates to me." Number two, people say, "My situation pitted me against impossible odds, where I literally had no opportunity or no choice other than to fail." And number three, I just hear over and over, even from professing believers, people say, "My particular sin is really not that serious." Well, contextually, we've been going through the book of 1 Corinthians. And particularly the strong believers, the ones who have a strong conscience, who feel like grace has set them free to do all kinds of things, they've overstepped the bounds of what the Bible actually says is wrong. So they're going back into these idol temples that God has rescued them out of, and they're sitting down with pagans, and they're feasting, and they're drinking, they're even committing immorality, and they're saying it's all okay. They're using all these excuses that I just shared with you. And I wonder, do they, in Paul's day, or do we today, do we really believe what we're even saying? Do we believe our own story? That we were against impossible odds, we're the first person that's ever encountered this? Or is our excuse making, is our blame shifting, is our denial, is our rationalization really just a way of saying, "I refuse to take personal responsibility for my sin"? And why do we do that? Because bottom line underneath it all, and I see it over and over and over again, not just in your lives, not just in counselees' lives, but in my life, when we take these tactics, when we do these excuses, it's ultimately because we just don't want to repent. We don't want to stop doing what we're doing. We certainly don't want to go and face another person and say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong and I hurt you. Will you please forgive me? What I said was insensitive. What I said was unkind. What I said wasn't even true. Will you forgive?" We don't want to do that. And so we make excuses. But this denial, this rationalizing, this blame shifting, the reason I'm taking a few moments here this morning to talk to you about it is because I want you to realize it leads to spiritual paralysis. What I mean is you can't go anywhere on your spiritual journey until you first say, "I'm done with the excuses. I'm stopping the excuses, the rationalizations, and I'm acknowledging that I have a problem." You know, even recovery programs like AA, You know what step one of the 12 steps is? Even they're smart enough to recognize you're not going to get anywhere in counseling and recovery until number one, you admit it's my own responsibility and I have a problem. So Paul's doing here is he's basically saying, look, church, you are never going to have victory over temptation, over trials in your life until you stop making excuses. And here's how he says this. Number one, he says, your temptation is not unique. Look at the very first phrase in the verse. He says, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. In other words, whatever you're facing in your life, it's ubiquitous. It is part and parcel of being a human being. Don't sit there and say, nobody understands, nobody can relate to me. The truth of the matter is, according to this verse and according to life experience, a whole lot of other people have experienced the exact same thing as you. There's some other counselors here, friends of mine. They probably hear this sort of thing too. I'm the first person that's ever faced this. Well, what's funny is, and it's not funny, but it's ironic, is that after you've heard hundreds and hundreds of counselees, you've heard the exact same story over and over again, and every story basically boils down to like three or four or five stories. And all these people are saying, my situation is completely unique. Paul says, your situation is not unique. And I realize, look, and I'm the same way as you. Nobody wants to admit, I face the same struggles as everyone else, and when other people stand, I fall. Why? Because that's admitting I'm weaker, or I choose sin when other people choose to do right. And it's easier to say, my situation is unique. You know, the other one I'm running into more and more these days is just this, it's a different way of saying my situation is unique. People now, Christians even, or professing Christians, they'll sit here and I'll say, can you read this verse out loud for me? And they'll read it. And I'll say, what does that verse say? And they'll say, well, this verse says that I'm sinning. And I say, what are you going to do about it? And they say, who wrote that? Well, the Apostle Paul wrote that under inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Okay, how many years ago was that? 2,000 years ago? Okay, you can't sit here and tell me that the Apostle Paul foresaw the kind of temptation that I would be facing in my life today with the internet. Well, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that Paul foresaw, you know, gas-powered engines and the internet and television and a whole lot of things. But we're kind of skirting around the point. And one writer puts it this way. The temptations believers face are not new. The external circumstances may differ, but the spiritual dynamics remain unchanged. The human propensity to see my problem as different or worse than what anyone else has experienced is decisively debunked. Decisively debunked, not just scripturally by a God who knows truth, but by experience where we see that there's nothing new under the sun. At the core, all that's in the world, lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life. That's it. And you can see a whole lot of new manifestations of those three things, but there's nothing else besides those three things. Stop making excuses. Your temptation is not unique. Number two, Paul says, furthermore, your temptation is not impossible. Notice he says, God will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able or beyond your ability. So he's saying under no circumstances will God allow you to face a temptation or an adversity in your life that is beyond the ability that he gives you to endure it in a God-honoring way. You will never sin because you are overwhelmed by an impossible force. You will sin and I will sin because we want to. I realize it's harder to admit that. I choose sin than to sit there and say, well, you don't understand. My situation is unique. I got swept along by these forces. I got stuck. There was no way out. You know, and again, so many of the people that I counsel, you would think that they are just the most benign, God-fearing follower of Jesus that's out there. And suddenly, as they're sleeping in the middle of the night as a hapless victim, this tornado of temptation swept through their house and just devastated their life. And they had nothing to do with it. But we need to stop pretending that our situations are impossible, because to do so is to call God a liar and to say that what he promises here is not true. Finally, we need to stop pretending like our sin is not as serious as it is. And I will preach grace and the grace of Jesus Christ and the gospel, hopefully as much as anyone you know. But let me help you understand, grace does not say it's okay to sin, and grace does not say that sin is not serious. In fact, I would pose to you the idea that grace actually shows us how serious our sin is. Because if God sat here and said, okay, for lying, you have to do this. Memorize three verses on lying. Boom, those offset. For adultery, man, that's way more serious. So you have to read the entire book of Leviticus and memorize three verses on adultery and attend church every Sunday for 3 months. Now, God never does this offset system. You know why? Because there's nothing we can do to offset our sin. That's how serious it is. He says the only thing that offsets your sin is the death of my son on the cross and you just believing that. Grace actually shows us how serious our sin is by saying there's nothing you can do to pay for it. You have to trust me to pay for it. But I see this attitude in the church even today where our sin just isn't that big a deal. And, you know, incredibly, the proof that I hear over and over again is that people point to the fact that this person did this and they're doing fine. God didn't smite them. They seem happy. They seem fine. So clearly that sin cannot be that serious. And here's what we've done is going back to last week, we've taken the grace of God and turned it into lasciviousness and presumption, saying, well, if God's not going to kill us on the spot when we sin, obviously it's not that serious. It's not that big a deal. And we see this over and over and over again where people are pointing to God's kindness and God's patience and God's long-suffering nature and saying, I'll presume on that too. Because if my sin were that serious, God wouldn't let me do this. And Paul says here under this first point, he says, your sin is not okay. That's what the whole context is saying here. He's saying, yes, God is incredibly patient and filled with grace. And God is forgiving if you ask for his forgiveness and you mean it and you turn from your sin. But Paul's point right here is that you can't go on making these excuses and saying my sin isn't a big deal. And the stories that he points to in the Old Testament are showing how again and again God put up with his people sinning and sinning and sinning and sinning. And finally he said, I love you too much. There has to be discipline. So that's your number one point right there. If you're sinning, if you're in the midst of temptation, if you're in the midst of a trial and you say this therefore excuses misbehavior, just understand it doesn't. Stop making excuses. But then going on here, Paul says, I don't want to just say what not to do. I don't want to just say, okay, with these excuses, it's like you're standing in this pit and you're digging your hole deeper. Let me show you now the way out. Point two, look to God. Stop making excuses. Stop digging the pit deeper. Look to God. Look up. Get out. See, going on here in this verse, Paul writes, yes, you have these temptations, but God is faithful. And he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but will with the temptation also provide the way of escape. This is encouraging. He says, when you find yourself being worn down by temptation, and when it feels like everything is closing in on you and pinching you so tight, you have no choice except to do that one thing that you know you're not supposed to do. He says, you have this option to look up to God, to meditate on and to see his faithful character. See that? By the way, James 1:13 says you will never, ever be tempted by God. God is not evil and he does not tempt you with evil. So if God is faithful, that means that no enticement to sin will ever come from God. What comes from God is that when that temptation comes, he provides a way out. Paul is saying your ultimate hope in the midst of every temptation, your ultimate hope in the midst of every trial is nothing less than the faithful character of God. One writer says it this way. He says the hand that governs all our circumstances is that of a God who is totally faithful, so that while we have no ability to stand or any security of foothold in and of ourselves, we can be completely confident in him. But that cuts both ways. The faithful character of God may be very encouraging to you. It may be much of a rebuke to you. As a child, seeing my dad was a very good thing or a very bad thing, depending on one thing, what I was doing when I saw him, right? If my dad said, son, I want you to go out in the backyard and rake the leaves until I come out. And I say, okay, dad. If I go out and I start raking the leaves and I start getting these piles of leaves built up, well, then dad pops his head out and dad's presence is a very encouraging thing because dad is bigger than I am and dad is stronger than I am and he's there to help and he can move big piles of wet leaves in a hurry. But if I'm in the backyard and I decide my brother is annoying the mess out of me, I'm going to fight my brother. I'm going to see if I can put my brother in a headlock. And right then my dad walks out. Well, then my dad's presence is not a good thing. It cuts both ways. He's kept his word. He said he was going to come out in an hour. There he is in an hour. But it's what I'm doing that makes that either really good news or really bad news. Let's apply that to what Paul is saying here. Let's say that you're weak. Let's say that you're discouraged. Let's say that you're doing your best to honor God and to walk faithfully through a trial or temptation. Do you know what God's faithfulness says to you? It says, be encouraged, because I'm there. God's faithfulness says, I will never, ever leave you. I will never forsake you. In the midst of every single trial and temptation you ever face, I will be faithful to you to give you everything you need for life and godliness in that moment, in that temptation, in that trial. You can rely on me. And I want to talk to you right now, if you're in that boat and you say, because of an adversity, because of a test, because of maybe a persistent temptation, and you say, right now, this morning, I feel discouraged, very discouraged. This verse right here speaks hope into your life because it says God is for you. Okay? So if you're in the midst of that trial, you can expect God to be doing something good in your life. Turn to James 1 with me, if you would, for a second. I just referenced verse 13. It's a great chapter to just hold side by side with this verse here. Give you a little bit better understanding of temptations and trials and adversity in the Christian life. But in James chapter 1, listen to what James says in verses 2 through 4. He says, count it all joy, my brothers and sisters, when you meet trials of various kinds. Count it all joy. No, you don't understand, James. Like, trials and temptations, that's when we give up. We throw up our hands and we say, it's more, it's impossible, or nobody can really. No, he says, count it all joy, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So if you're that person and you're in the midst of a temptation or trial and you say, I feel beat down, I feel like I'm at the end of my rope and I'm barely hanging on, take hold of a verse like that and say, Lord, you have promised that in the midst of this pain, in the midst of this temptation, you are there and you're doing something good in my life to develop godly character, to conform me more into the image of Jesus Christ. And I'm going to claim this promise and I'm going to hold on to it. And if I let go, Lord, you hang on to me. But the flip side of that, and I need to talk to a different group of people, and that is those who will say, you know, because my situation is impossible or difficult or sin's not that big a deal, or you're just sitting there rationalizing and excusing, God's faithfulness is not good news for people who want to presume to sin. It's a rebuke. It's a warning. Because what God's faithfulness says, if you're going to continue to sin, is it says this sin that you're committing, that I'm committing, it has nothing to do with whether or not God is there. It has everything to do with our own personal choice. You know, you look at the context again of this verse where Paul goes on and on to say that here is God in the wilderness with his Old Testament people, Israel, and he has delivered them and he is leading them and protecting them and comforting them and guiding them and providing for all of their needs constantly. His presence is never without them for a moment. And yet they're sinning their brains off. So, you know, if God had checked out on Israel, they may have had a case. They may have been able to say, God, the reason why we were complaining and grumbling so much is because we looked for you and you weren't there. The reason why we turned to idols is because we thought you'd forsaken us. We couldn't find you when we prayed to you. But they couldn't say that, could they? Because there's the pillar of cloud. There's the pillar of fire. There's the tabernacle in their midst. There's the presence and power of God. And the same is true in our lives that Paul is saying already through this book. Look, God is with you and he's for you. And frankly, the reason we sin is by choice and not because God is unfaithful to us, but because we are unfaithful to him. So don't for a moment presume on the faithfulness of God to say, well, you know, when I was 4 or 10 or 16, I prayed a prayer. I punched the card. I got my fire insurance. I'm on my way to heaven. That is not the Christian life. The Christian life is to always say, and this is now going to be your final point, God's faithful character inspires me and empowers me to respond faithfully. So the scripture is never this let go and let God approach that you hear in the church sometimes today, where it's just like, you know, hey, look, stop making excuses. Just look to God and he will like magically lift you out of every trial. That's not what this verse says. This verse basically says that when you stop making excuses and you look to God, then you'll realize God has put resources in my life that I now need to take advantage of. Look at what these are. Going back to this verse, he says, God will also, with the temptation, provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Paul's actually not giving one resource. He's giving two possible resources. First of all, he says, God may give you an exit by which to escape the temptation or to escape the trial. The word escape here in this verse, it literally refers to one of two things, either an end point to a duration, like, God, I put up with this trial for so long, this temptation has pursued me for so long, and God says, end, done, it's over. Or it can refer to not an end point, but literally an escape route, like a mountain pass that you have to choose to take to escape. By the way, the reason I read verse 14 is because it goes on to say, flee from idolatry. So right there in the next verse, Paul's giving you an illustration of what I'm talking about. God may give you an exit, and when that exit appears, however small, however tight it is, you got to get through there quick. And one writer says, I think very practically, to flee implies speed and determination to get out. Speed and determination to put as much distance between yourself and whatever's after you as possible. Flee immorality, flee lust, flee pride, flee idolatry, as he says here in verse 14, flee all these things. If you are tempted by something, a person, a place, a thing, a reminder, stop doing that thing. You know, if being in a certain place tempts you to sin, run from that place. If being around a certain person tempts you to sin, then find a way to graciously remove yourself from that person. Now, if it's another believer, you probably should get a third-party mediator and work things out. But you know, if, you know what I'm talking about. If it's a situation at work or something like that where you're tempted to sin with another person, it's okay to say, you know what, we shouldn't be friends because our relationship is illicit. So I'm getting away. There's an escape route here. We don't have to be friends. I don't have to stay late at work. I don't have to sit around and watch television in the middle of the night with no accountability or surf the internet with no accountability. So whatever that thing is, God is probably providing you with ways of escape that you need to run through those ways and actually get out. By the way, if that sounds a little extreme to you, you actually cut people off or cut off your cable subscription or whatever that thing is for you. I'm not setting rules for you. If that sounds extreme, do you know how Jesus said the same thing? Because it's more extreme than what I'm saying. Jesus said, if your hand causes you to stumble into sin, cut it off. He said, if your eye causes you to stumble into sin, pluck it out. Now, I actually am one that don't think he was being literal. I think he was using a figure of speech to show how desperately we need to practice radical amputation. And sometimes in our lives, we need to amputate sources of temptation. Rather than sitting there week after week, after month, after year, just continuing to walk the same path of temptation, saying, look, if God is good, he's going to help me withstand. No. If you play with fire, this is what Proverbs says. If you take fire into your bosom, guess what's going to happen? You're going to get burned. So don't take fire into your bosom. Run. Get away from the source of sin. Stop doing that thing. One writer says, the believer must respond not by expecting all temptation to be magically removed, but by taking the exit path which God provides, marks, and renders the believer able to use. Now, with this last point, I go on here to address the fact that there are times in your lives when you can't run. In fact, to run, to flee, would be a sin. You know, a very simple example is your marriage. God doesn't say if your spouse annoys you, get out, get away, flee that wife. He says, love her the way Christ loved the church. Okay, we're an obnoxious bride. We're a sinful bride. God has to put up with a lot with us, but he does because he has steadfast love and he's always pursuing and always showing grace and justice and mercy and forgiving. So I say God gives you not one resource, but two. The first one is this. He may give you an exit by which to escape, but this verse goes on to say he may also or instead give you the ability by which to endure. So I'm talking to anyone right now who you would say, I feel right now stuck in a bad marriage, or I feel stuck in a bad job, or my finances, I'm in this cycle of really bad finances that I can't get out of, or my health, or it's a combination of factors. I'm depressed. And emotionally, I can't break out of this cycle of stuff. It's not just a matter of like, oh, okay, take the exit route right there. I don't see the exit route. Then it may very well be that God is doing the second part of the end of this verse where he's saying, maybe I haven't given you an endpoint right now or a way of escape, but I will, I promise, faithfully, to give you the ability to endure what I put in your life. So if you feel stuck, and if you feel like you can't survive another day with what God has put on your plate, if you feel like the grace that I got today is not going to be enough to hang on one more day, I'd say that's okay, because God never said that it would be. God never said that the grace I give you today will be okay for tomorrow. What he says is the grace I give you today is enough for today. And if you need more grace tomorrow, I will give you more grace tomorrow. And if you need more grace than that the next day, I'll give you more grace than that the next day. Because God is not just depositing like this massive sum of grace into our lives and then walking away and saying, spend it wisely. He's saying, look, I am right there with you every day. And if you need more today, I'm there. And I'm observing your need. And if you need more today, I'm here. And if you need more, I'm here. He's actually promising his presence, which is more important than just a big deposit, saying, spend wisely. God doesn't do that with grace and say, you got to kind of guess what's going to happen down the road. He says, I will always be there every day. That's why we read Lamentations chapter 3 this morning. If you want to look at your order of worship, what is this promise? What is Lamentations 3, 21 through 24 promise? That the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every single morning. Great is thy faithfulness. So again, I am talking to you if you're continuing to presumptuously sin and say, well, my temptation is unique. It's different. It's more powerful than anything that anyone can understand. And my sin's not that big deal anyway. I am talking to you and I'm saying, please stop. You are hurting yourself spiritually by presuming on God. And God's faithfulness is a warning to you. But honestly, mostly I'm talking to those of you, and that's most of us, who are just from day to day, from time to time, or maybe even just constantly, we feel like we're struggling. And this passage, as short as it is packed with promise for you. You look for the escape route. You look for the grace. You look for the ability that God is giving you. You look for the grace. And it will always, always, always be there for you. Even in adult life, we spend tremendous amounts of creativity and emotional energy thinking like, how can I do this? And then rationalize it and then blame it on somebody else and then pretend like I'm not covered up. What if you took all that creativity and emotional energy and said, God, I'm in with you. You are faithful and I want to respond faithfully to a faithful God. And all that creativity, all that energy will now be spent looking for the escape route that you have for me. Talking to other people and saying, how have you successfully navigated this temptation in your life? Or I see I'm facing a financial struggle right now. I know that you've gone through the same thing. Let's sit down and talk and let's share how we see God working in our lives to give us either grace or the grace of an exit. I close with this quote on the front of your orders of worship. One writer says, believers can never claim that they could not help themselves in the face of pressure to abandon covenant faithfulness. For God will ensure, as part of his own covenant faithfulness, that he will not simply leave them to face impossible odds. His grace provides ever new opportunities for human faithfulness. And that's where I leave you with the question of, because God is faithful to you, will you grab onto that faithfulness? Love and worship God for that faithfulness. Trust that faithfulness and respond faithfully when you face temptation and trial.